you'd like to join us as we take a look at the history of prisons in Australia, and specifically, well, maximum security prisons, the conditions, what it's like for prisoners, what it's like for people who work there, if you've been through one and toured one over the years, and you'd like to talk about, I guess, if you were shocked at the conditions that prisons and prisoners were in and the conditions that they lived in. James Morton is the author of a book called Maximum Security and joins us on the program. Good morning, James.
Morning, Trevor.
Of course, we've spoken to James on many occasions. You've got a thing about criminals, James.
Well, I was a lawyer for many, many years, and it's sort of a natural sort of... I was a criminal lawyer, and it's a natural progression.
James...
You're meant to write about the things you know something about, and it's no use my writing on beekeeping or anything like that.
I mean, was it fair to say that Australia was... that all of Australia was basically a maximum security prison?
Oh, yeah, I think initially transportation was to America, but after the American War of Independence, which the Brits lost, as you know, they had to find somewhere else, you know, to dump their prisoners, and Australia seemed very suitable. It was a long way away, and frankly, it was a question of out of sight, out of mind. The authorities, you know, got rid of people they considered either dangerous politically or dangerous in a criminal sense, and that was fine. Just send them over there if they get a ticket of leave, which allowed them to return, so well and good, but they were never going to escape back to Britain, so, you know, no problems.
James, this is, we hear a lot about why people were sent to Australia, and a lot of it was for petty crime. Were the hardened, really hardened criminals who were out here for murder and so forth, were they in with the same sort of area as the people in there for petty crime?
Oh, yes, they were just all sort of locked up together and put on a boat and off they went. So, yes, they were all the same, in the same boat, literally. They arrived and then, of course, the lesser criminals would be sent off to work for local masters, and the recidivists would be sent off to places like Norfolk Island, which was no fun at all.
Tell us a bit about Norfolk Island.
Well, apparently a very, very beautiful place, and it was an absolute hell on earth for the prisoners. The order of the day was the lash. Any sort of minor infringement was dealt with brutally. You couldn't expect, if you were sent to Norfolk Island, you couldn't expect to come off it for 10 years. And really, again, the authorities didn't care what happened, provided the prisoners were kept under control. And back in England, the idea was that prisons should be, and conditions in Australia should be brutal to dissuade people from committing crime here.
Is Norfolk Island then where people were sent who committed harsher crimes within Australia as well?
Yes, yes. They were. Once you'd committed a second major crime, robbery, murder, manslaughter, you could expect to go to Norfolk Island.
When did we start to see prisons as we know them within Australia?
Roughly, I should think, about 1850. I mean, until then, there were sort of stockades, which were sort of not terribly secure and were guarded, but were not prisons as we know them, like I think one of the first is, of course, Pentridge, the Bluestone College, which is built around 1850. And, I mean, one of the things which brought it about was a really evil man called John Price, who was the prison inspector, had been on Norfolk Island and ruled it with appalling brutality, came to Williamstown and was murdered by convicts who were in prison ships, which were, of course, totally unsuitable to keep men with any idea of reform. And they got him off the... or he agreed to meet a number of prisoners to discuss conditions, and they turned on him. Someone threw a clod of earth at him, and he turned his back on them and ran. And once he did that, his authority just evaporated in a matter of steps, and they killed him. And after that, it was a matter of priority, or that was one of the reasons why one started getting proper, secure prisons.
How much did Pentridge actually change over the years?
Well, from the start, it was a pretty sort of dire place to be in. And really, at the end, it wasn't really very much better. I mean, you've got the terrible H block, then you had Jaika-Jaika, insanitary, as indeed all prisons were, both in Australia, England, America. They were placed with no sanitation or no proper sanitation, poor food, running walls, water running down the walls, no sort of real effort at rehabilitation, until we certainly come to what, the 20s, 30s.
Tony joins us, who worked at Pentridge from 1977 to 1980. Hello, Tony.
Hi, Tony.
How are you?
Good. Tell us about the Pentridge that you know.
Well, after 3 years in the Air Force, I joined Pentridge Jail in 1977, and I was told then that I was the youngest prison officer in 120 years of history. Pentridge, as always, already been stated, was built around 1850-1854 by prisoners that extracted the bluestone out of the Merri Creek nearby. And yeah, in 1977 I commenced work there, and I thought I was growing up at 21, but I soon learned that I wasn't, and it was a very tough job.
What were the conditions like for prisoners? Can you explain that to us?
Oh, look, they haven't changed much, I don't think, in the 120 years prior to me working there. The bluestone walls, the bars, the general environment, probably the food as well, hadn't changed much. I think the medication side of things might have improved. But overall well-being of prisoners, I don't think, left a lot to be desired. And I think the welfare of the prison officers wasn't looked after all that much either.
Joe, I'll come back to you, Tony. James, can you tell us did you want to ask Tony anything while we're going along, James?
No, not at the moment, but I will do in a moment, please.
Well, James, what were the cells like for the prisoners?
Well, they were pretty basic. They didn't have, for example, a lavatory. There was a bed. Sometimes it was secured to the ground, sometimes it was a concrete bed, there was a chair and a table. And that was in most of the prisons, certainly in the maximum security prisons, that was just about it. Of course, if you're talking about prison farms and things, then conditions were a lot better. But in the maximum security, and Tony, I hope, will agree with me, that was about all you got.
Tony?
Well, to a degree, I'd agree with that. However, in the late 60s, early 1970s, prior to me joining there, there was a big political change to do with the prisons, because Ryan was the last man hung there at Pentridge, and the politics or the politicians finally folded under the public pressure. So what occurred in the early 1970s was a transformation in terms of a mentality of give the prisoners what they want and they might not want to escape and cause trouble. And that led to, right up to beyond my period there, as a very frustrating period for the prison officers, because there was no discipline and so on and so forth. Whereas prior to 1970, the discipline was extremely harsh, and indeed another extreme compared to when I worked there.
Mm.
But also an additional problem occurred when you gave prisoners luxuries like television sets and so on. It created more opportunities to hide things, particularly drugs. So the actual jail changed a lot around about that period. And once you give a prisoner any luxury, or what perceived luxury, it's very hard to take it off them without some sort of violent reaction. So I'm not advocating one way or the other whether they should have got it or not. It just made a lot difficult.
Thanks for joining us.
That's all right. No worries, Trevor.
All the best.
Bye-bye, James. Bye-bye.
Sorry, go on, James.
No, I was... I was just saying goodbye to Tony.
Because one of the, I've got a text here that says I toured around Fremantle Prison, and until 1991, they still used a bucket for their toilet during the night. I don't know about you, but that ain't exactly a holiday camp for me, says Ian. Fremantle Prison, I didn't change very much.
I think that's right. Mind you, they're still using buckets in some English prisons. There's a campaign at the moment to try and eradicate that. So things haven't really changed anywhere.
Those conditions, I guess, because Fremantle Prison was a fairly harsh prison. We've talked about a lot of the maximum security prisons and how they've changed. Along with that, what are the other ones that have been considered notorious? I guess Port Arthur is another one.
Port Arthur, certainly in the early days, was dreadful. I mean, that was just about one step below Norfolk Island. And, of course, Moreton Bay up in Queensland was exactly the same. Really harsh discipline. And, of course, the old Boggo Road jail was a terrible place in Queensland, in Brisbane. Boggo Road was really, really quite a dreadful place. I mean, they had punishment cells which were black holes. Literally under the, under the underground, no light, no sanitation at all. Sort of a bit of bread and some water thrust on you once a day. And I think that Lionel Murphy went round and did not Murphy, but a senior judge went round Boggo Road into the punishment cells and said that if he hadn't known other people were in this cell, which was about sort of 6 foot by 8 or 10 foot, you know, a couple of metres by a couple of metres, he wouldn't have actually been able to see them. The conditions were so black.
I've got a text here.
The stench was appalling, and the heat was, of course, going to be appalling.
A text that says, Trevor, I've never been a criminal, but I know that just visiting the old Melbourne jail scared the bejesus out of me. As a kid, they had a dummy in a cell, which my brother and I were not expecting at all. I guess when you actually take a look at those prisons and conditions, if you actually just showed people where they would be and the conditions they'd live in, it might have been as big a deterrent as anything else.
Sorry, well, the trouble is that prison will deter some people and it won't others. I mean, I would be sort of absolutely humiliated by being in, you know, going into court into the dock instead of the lawyer's benches, and that would put me off committing crime. But for some people, prisons are home from home. Indeed, it's a lot easier in prison, and there's no statistical evidence that probation, community service, prison, long sentences, short sentences will do anything to stop recidivism. One thing might help and stop me, one thing might stop you, but it might not stop everybody.
Terry joins us.
Something different. That's the problem.
Hello, Terry.
Hello.
Hi. Yeah, g'day, Terry.
Yeah, how you going?
Good, Terry. Now, you've been to prison.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, and have you? I'm not going to ask you why, but have you been to maximum security?
Look, when you go to jail now in Nursey, I think everyone puts straight in mainstream, as they call it. It's maximum, no matter who you are, what you do.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Can you? Because a lot of people say that going to prison now is too easy. What do you say to them?
Well, it depends, like. My mate was saying, back in the day, I remember visiting my sister's boyfriend in Beechworth Jail, going to Pentridge, visiting. It's a freezing cold place where you wouldn't want to go. And then I'm in North Queensland. I've been in jail up here. It's, as you say, like a holiday camp compared to that. It's, it's hard to explain.
What's the worst part about going to prison, Terry?
The boredom. You just sit there and think. You've got nothing to do except think about what you've done.
Does that actually stop people from going to prison, Terry?
How do you mean?
Well, does it stop people from reoffending going to prison?
Well, some people, like I might say.
Yep.
Yeah, it can either make or break, I suppose.
Well, tell us about what you saw, like visiting people in Pentridge.
I can't remember Pentridge, I was too young, but I remember Beechworth. Also, I remember it was so freezing cold and, like, down south there, it's, you know, like, it's not open anymore, but, yeah, the kind of place you wouldn't want to live in.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
And you're going all right now?
Oh yeah, I'm fine, Danny. But then you come up Queensland and you've got aircon and TV and PlayStations, kettles, TV. You know, like you said, you're better off being there sometimes. Depends who you are.
Yeah, good on you. Thanks for giving us a call, Terry.
Yeah, no, thank you.
All the best. So things have changed a little bit in prison compared to what it used to be, James.
Well, I think that's right. But what I think one's got to try and do with prisons is education. I was talking to a Victorian corrections officer, and he was saying that one of the great problems was a lack of literacy. Even people who perhaps run drug gangs and run them very successfully at a high level, when it turns out that they can't read and write. And I think there's got to be, and again, this applies just as well to England, there's got to be a literacy, an effort to educate prisoners, because otherwise, when they come out, what are they going to do? Go back to their old ways.
A text here that's saying, I did 12 months in C Division in Pentridge. A bench, a bed, a bucket, and earphone to listen to, only to TV. It was cold and terrible food, and many suicides.
Yeah, I think that's one of the problems, that there is a high death rate in prisons, not only suicides, but also there's an awful lot of murders have been going on in prison over the years. And I think possibly the situation is no better with the amount of drugs which are washing around prisons.
Actually, I've got a text here that says, most people in jail now are drug addicts, not criminals. That's one of the differences, says Tomo.
I think that's right. I mean, I don't think there were real serious drug problems until, the 1970s. And the drug problem has now escalated enormously. And, of course, there are tremendous profits to be made from drugs. The old-fashioned, old Victorian criminals such as Joey Turner and people like that of the 1960s and 70s. I mean, they might have a bottle of whiskey smuggled in at Christmas, and they might have a few cigarettes. And, of course, there were tobacco barons, but now there is a whole industry being conducted from inside prison. I mean, again, not only, Australia, but also, again, America, England, I should think every country in the world has got the same drugs problem in prison.
James, these are high-security prisons. They're for the most hardened of criminals. What are some of the more recognised escapes that have happened from these high-security prisons?
Well, there was... I was going to say, where would you like to start? There was a splendid woman who actually just walked out of Pentridge in about 1860, dressed up in the governor's wife's clothes. And she stayed out for about a year before she got dobbed in. But on a more serious level, I mean, there's been escapes such as Queensland, Brendan Abbott. There was a sort of machine gun escape. Angel wire, which cuts through bars, was smuggled in, and he led a six-man escape while he was being covered with machine gun fire, which kept the warders down. That was one of the more recent escapes. One of the best escapes, of course, has to be Russell Cox, who got out of Cattingall in New South Wales and actually got back into the maximum security unit there. Was within an ace of getting all the rest of the prisoners out of it the next year.
Really?
And that was really what shut the prison down. I mean, it was in trouble, of course, by then with the prison inquiries which were going on. But to find an ex-prisoner, I say it was Cox, it was always believed to be Cox, on the roof, or at least two men on the roof trying to cut through it, was, I think, the end of the prison as such. And then, of course, there was Jica was meant to be escape-proof, but it wasn't. I mean, six men got out of Jica the year before the fire, or a couple of years before the fire. So there have been some tremendous escapes. And, of course, one of the, I mean, Long Bay down in Sydney, there was the escape of Simmons and Newcomb, if you recall. a warder was killed, and of course there was the one which led to the hanging of Ryan from Pentridge, when he and his fellow, I think he's called Walker, got out at Christmas, or just before Christmas, the guard was shot in the escape.
Brenda joins us. Hello, Brenda.
Oh, hello there.
What do you want to talk about, Brenda?
Oh, sure, about Berrima Jail. There's a rather interesting thing about that. First Fleeters, John Small family, is probably the best known, best documented of all the First Fleet families. And John Small was a First Fleeter, and his grandson was a governor of Berrima Jail. And there's quite a few books apparently written about the old Berrima Jail. And apparently he featured pretty strongly as a man who had some fairly original ideas of punishment.
Mm.
He had some sort of invented some sort of a gag that they put on them. And it was, the interesting thing was, we went down there, it was late 80s, early 90s, for a reunion of the family. And we understood that Berrima Jail had been closed down, and it was sort of just a tourist attraction. So we strolled up to the door and knocked and said, you know, could we have a look through here? And the bloke that had the door said, you most certainly can't. I've got 32 high-security prisoners here. So,
Thank you. James, are you aware of that prison?
Yeah, I think in the old days, if you got 3 years in Victoria, you spent your first 9 months in more or less in solitary confinement. This is, we're talking about the 1860s, and Brenda was talking about Small and his punishment. I've got a bit which says, the only light, he will wash his feet twice in the summer and once in winter weekly. The confinement cell was 2.5 by 1.5 metres. The light came through a grate, and they were gagged, and they had what was called the spread eagle, where you got chained in the crucifix position to a wall. And the gag was put in your mouth with a wooden plug, and the difficulty was that you couldn't breathe except through a hole in this plug. I mean, it was terrible. And indeed, there was a royal commission which Small sort of circumvented. And he stayed the governor for years, 10, 12 years.
A text here that says, I worked with a guy who served time in Boggo Road, a tough place, plus I had work functions in the yard and got to tour the heritage-listed buildings at Boggo. Very creepy place, sent chills down my spine, but some amazing artwork on the walls.
Yes, I could believe that. Prisoners got nothing else to do, and they decorate themselves one way or another. And, of course, some people are extremely talented artists.
Did you hear, as you're talking to people about the prisons, and especially the maximum security ones, did people talk about the hauntings of them, James?
No, not that I've... not personally have I heard of them, but, of course, one has heard all these stories that, you know, the jails are haunted. And I think Boggo Road was one which was... particularly haunted. I think there's actually a nighttime tour of ghosts of Boggo Road, of prisoners who've died and whose ghosts are said to live on. I think it's the same with every prison. There are going to be stories of that told possibly by old legs to frighten the new ones.
How many of the prisons that are recognised like Fremantle, the same as this different sections of Pentridge, how many of those prisons are still existed and how have they been changed?
Well, they've been changed because, of course, there's been improved security, one thing. I think in the maximum securities, one can never say never, but there certainly aren't the escapes or the escape attempts there were. I remember talking to an English prisoner called McVicker, who was a great escaper, And he said that provided a door opens, there's always a chance of an escape, but it has really been cut down with electronics now to a bare minimum. Of course, you're always going to get somebody like Killick. Someone's going to land a helicopter in the prison yard and off and away, or up and away, I should say. But conditions have changed. I mean, there's no doubt that, I mean, the sanitation is very, very different in these places now. The cooking is obviously a great deal better. There are televisions, there are exercise, well, there are gymnasiums, although up in Queensland, that didn't stop the prisoners killing another prisoner with the weights. So,
exactly.
That's, of course, one of the difficulties. As I think it was Terry was saying, first of all, you give a prisoner something and then they'll want something more, and the more they're given, well, the argument is that the more they're given, the more dangerous they can become.
We'll just go back to another call. Marty joins us. Good morning, Marty.
Hey, Trev, how are you?
Good, Marty.
Trev, I don't really want to talk about maximum security. I've been there, done that. That's Sarah Island, James, in southwest Tasmania. I've toured that area.
Sarah Island of southwest Tasmania?
I don't think I've covered that one in my book. Tell me about it.
No, it was supposedly one of the worst of the worst, and when it was decommissioned, they basically destroyed it because it was so severe, and it was in the middle of, well, not in the middle of Macquarie Harbour, but that's one of the biggest harbours in the world with the narrowest entrance. You know, it's 25 square mile or something. But the people that used to play up, they used to have a little rock out in the away from the island, and you know, a smaller island, only a rock hanging out of the water. They used to chain them up to the rock so the tide could come over them, you know, for punishment.
I can believe that, yeah. And we're talking back in the, I hope we're talking back in the 1800s, the late 1800s.
Yeah, oh, way
yeah. Yes, and I mean, even sort of back to the 30s, I mean, Hobart Prison, the conditions there were pretty dreadful. The prison doctor said, my animals are treated better.
As far as Tasmania concerned, Hobart Prison and Port Arthur, were they the main prisons where the most serious of prisoners were held?
Is that to me? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. They were maximum security, as it were. They weren't called that in those days, but yes, they were maximum security. And again, Port Arthur was a really dreadful place. As I say, one step below Norfolk Island.
Tony joined us. He's got a quick story about Sarah Island. Hello, Tony.
Yeah, I'm ringing back, actually, Trevor. Sarah Island's very, very interesting. There's a book called The Men That God Forgot that is all about Sarah Island, in particular the mutiny that occurred on the last ship that was leaving there in 1832.
Mm-hmm.
And the prison was in operation from 1821 to 1832.
Mm-hmm.
And when it was mutineered, the prisoners took the ship down near Antarctica and then up South America to Peru, where the Spanish looked after them, treated them like royalty, actually, for 20 years, until the Spanish made a deal with the English. And the English got them back, and the last prisoner that was he died on Norfolk Island.
Jeez.
James already mentioned Norfolk Island. So,
yeah.
But Sarah Island, that caller is very correct, was a brutal place, and it was maximum security. I can remember the bush tucker man doing a little documentary on five prisoners that did escape. And they cannibalised each other until one was left.
I remember that story.
Yeah, and the authorities, when they captured him, didn't believe his story that he'd done all that. They'd done all this, and until he escaped about 10 years later, and he cannibalised a farmer and his wife, and then they believed him.
See, James, that's when they started to eat well.
Yes. I was thinking, in the 1900s, a man called Eddie Guerin, an American, escaped from French prison colony Devil's Island, and he was said to have eaten his companions who were in the boat with him, and that's how he escaped. But one of the great escapes was from Western Australia when some Irish Fenian prisoners got away in about 1867. They were political prisoners, and a fellow sailed over from America and got them out and back to America.
There's a song about that, and I think there's...
That's right. I'm not going to sing it, but you could.
I'm not singing it. Hello, Ben.
Hello.
Yes, Ben.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up the jail, St. Helena Island, up in Moreton Bay in Brisbane.
Mm-hmm.
I've been there a few times as a younger fella, and, yeah, I remember them saying that they used to get the prisoners to work and mine the sandstone that they used to build the settlement buildings in the bay around Brisbane. And I was just curious whether there were other prisons around Australia where the convicts were used as workers as well as punishment.
James?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, there was one fellow who, in Darlinghurst Prison, a governor called Koch, that was K-O-C-H, in about the 1850s, ran the whole thing for his own benefit. The women were hired out as prostitutes. The talented men who were musicians were hired out as orchestras. He set up a sort of plantation for them to make hats, to breed animals, all for his own benefit. And this has been one of the complaints over the years in certain prisons, on and off, that prisoners have been made to work for the prison staff as opposed to working in prison as part of their punishment. They would obviously be made to work, but the prison staff, you know, used them as private labour.
James, we're literally a minute away from the news. Within your book, you not only take a look at the prisons, but also the prisoners within it. What other things do you take a look at?
Have a look at, the history and the prison inquiries which have gone on, which have changed prison for the better, and also to have a quick look and see, you know, what can be done to try and stop the brutality which has gone on, and indeed still goes on, perhaps prisoner to prisoner more than officer to prisoner now, to try and stop that.
It's always a pleasure talking to you on the program, James. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
James Moreton, who's an author and former London lawyer specialising in criminal defence, his book is called Maximum Security.